Welcome to Historias. I'm Stephen Hyland. I'm just delighted to welcome to the program Suzanne Luttrell, who is one of the more fascinating people I've had the pleasure to meet recently. I will only mention a few of Suzanne's many accolades and achievements with the idea that many others will come out in the coming discussion. Suzanne is a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at Georgia State University. She won the World History Association Teaching Prize in 2010. She has an MA in Chinese Studies from the University of Michigan, and recently served as guest editor of the peer-reviewed World History Bulletin, producing an issue entitled The World from Latin America, which was published in 2017. And this is only a slight glimpse into the very many cool things Suzanne Luttrell has accomplished to date. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited to chat with you today.
Well, thank you very much. So let's do this. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I, among other things, I've taken a long road to get to where I am today as a doctoral candidate at GSU in the Department of History. You could say I'm on a mission that is derived of my overseas upbringing. I was born in New York, but my dad's job took us to Rome, Singapore, and I spent my formative years in São Paulo, Brazil. Came to the United States for my senior year of high school, and it was total culture shock. And I went to high school in Ann Arbor, and that's why I went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I was terrified of being in the U.S. actually, and so I earned my degree, economics degree. With that, I bought a one-way ticket to Taiwan. I bolted out of the U.S. and learned Chinese with a Chinese family because at the time, really, the best language was in Taiwan to study Chinese. Backpacked through mainland China, left right at the start of the Tiananmen Square demonstrations, took the Trans-Siberian train back, came home and earned my MA in Chinese Studies at Michigan. Ended up, there were no jobs at the time, really, for me. I had no clue as far as how to, well, actually, I did receive an offer from Sinochem, which is on Wall Street, and this was a Chinese firm. My job was to sell gold futures, buy and sell gold futures on Wall Street. And on a personal note, actually, my mother had passed away, and I kind of went through this soul searching. I thought, what am I doing with my life? And so with that, I ended up working for a small family firm. This is on Long Island, and went to school at night to become a high school teacher because I thought about, well, how could I best contribute? And this is something, you know, what is my skill set and what do I have to offer? And I loved teaching English when I was in Taiwan. I knew I didn't want to be a language teacher. So I went back to school at night to earn my public school certification to teach social studies. And with that, I was hired. I was very, very, very lucky in a super tight job market. There were no jobs for high school history teachers at the time. I was hired at Bayshore High School where I did my student teaching with a wonderful Joe Nardi, fantastic mentor. I can talk about the importance of mentorship later. And I taught high school history for 14 years, technically 15. And then in 2012, my husband's job took us to the Atlanta area. And my son was in college, and my daughter was really angry at the time because we left New York and she left all her friends. And so I took a year to sort of settle her. And also along the way to teaching, we can talk more about this later, I wrote a young adult historical fiction series to go along with the AP World Curriculum, easy reading with themes that teachers can take in whatever direction they want. But it actually has been endorsed by the New York State Council for Social Studies. And anyway, so I took that year to do the author bit and hit middle schools and high schools and chat with and hold workshops on approaches to teaching to world history. And then, you know, Stephen, I've heard this often. I heard Bianca Premo discuss this recently, that writing is such an can be such an isolating process. And you never know, you're writing into the void, right? And so I thought, really need to be around more people on a regular basis. You know, it was me and the dog during the day. And then I'd go out to the schools, et cetera. And I really miss the collaboration, the camaraderie of being in a building. I could have taught high school history again, but I wanted a new challenge. So, and I love teaching high school. So I thought, I want to take a few classes in grad school in history. So armed with my transcripts, I made an appointment, I walked into the Georgia State Department of History, met with the then Director of Graduate Studies, Joe Perry, and we had a chat and about what I might want to do with this. And I really did not intend to pursue a PhD, but he sweet-talked me into it.
And, I know Joe. Joe's a good guy.
Yes, he is. And the next thing I know, you know, it was the end of July. And he said, well, you know, if you can get your paperwork together, no problem. Made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
So you go to grad school and you have all this experience in East Asia, and you choose Latin America.
Yes. That's right. So I have two reasons for that. One is derived from my experience in teaching AP World History. So I went maybe about 15 years ago, you know, as I was wading through the curriculum, and it's so frightening. At that point, when I was thrown into teaching the course, I had not taught world history past 1500, and it's a daunting exam. I think you've been to the read, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I have.
So, right, it's a tremendous amount of curriculum. And so as I was throwing myself into the curriculum and just learning more and just, and I looked at Latin America, and you know, how am I going to fit this in? And I delved into the sugar trade, and which, you know, as a teenager in Brazil, I never thought much about it. Even though, I will say, I had Portuguese all 8 years that I lived there, and towards the end, I almost received my diploma from my Brazilian high school diploma because I was there for so long. And in my Histórias do Brasil, which I took in 10th grade, it really, you know, the sugar trade is addressed, it's glossed over, and I start to delve into this a little bit more. And so as an AP World teacher, then I came back to this and I start to look at this a bit, you know, read Sidney Mintz's work. I was horrified, you know, again, as a teacher, just throwing myself deep into the hole of research so I can have plenty of material to offer the students and also just, you know, so I could understand what was happening a bit better. So that was one reason for why I ended up looking at Latin America. And plus, I had gone on this sugar strike. I used to have a blog called Sugar is the Devil. And it was derived of, you know, as I went on this basic sugar strike, as I told my students, well, let's think about the consumption of sugar, you know, what caused the largest forced migration in the history of the world. So I went into grad school with this because I wasn't sure. My language skills in Chinese were a bit shaky at this time. I can still speak Mandarin, but my writing skills, I can't write. I'm illiterate at this point. I had learned the traditional Chinese characters in Taiwan, and this was not offered at Georgia State. I actually looked into fine-tuning my Chinese language skills there. So I'm fluent in Portuguese. You know, I grew up there, and it was amazing how much came back to me. All of a sudden, all these words and phrases, and I mean, I sound like a teenager when I talk. You know, oi, you know, tudo bem. You know, I'm super. You know, I have to be careful. I don't sound. I need to work on my professionalism. So, in that regard.
Well, cool. So, tell us about the research project.
So, as in my very first semester, we had a wonderful, I was very lucky. So my advisor, JT Wei, sort of gave us a big project. And he said, you know, just find something. And we basically workshopped a great research project during the semester as we went through our readings. And he had suggested, given my interest in sugar, you know, of course, Stuart Schwartz has, I mean, there's so much that work that's been done. He said, well, why don't you take a look at this art? And he sent to me, he said, look at this guy, Franz Post. What's going on over there? And JT is a Guatemalanist, and he was just sort of throwing out ideas. And as I looked at, I love art. I'm an interdisciplinary instructor by nature. And as I was going through, as I was sifting through the art, I thought, this is very strange. The first landscape images out of the Americas came from this period, this Dutch-held Brazil. And I knew about the Dutch and Brazil, again, from growing up, from taking a study to Brazil in high school. But I didn't understand, I couldn't connect the images to the realities of what was actually happening on the ground. The spike in the slave trade, for instance. And you have these post and echoed, for instance, they share these gorgeous images. Again, first landscape images out of the Americas. The work of Piso and Marcref proved foundational for Linnaeus's classification in the fall system in the next century. And I started to look at what was Dutch Brazil. That was my original question. I just didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. And so I originally set out to explore the gap between the rhetoric and the reality of Dutch Brazil, and the rhetoric being just this great odes written about the Dutch in Brazil. And they were mostly commissioned by the then Governor General Johan Moritz, who held and expanded the Dutch grip on Northeast Brazil from 1637 to 1644. That was his period. But the Nassovian period, as it's been called, is really what's been written about the most. And so there's a story that's been perpetuated for 400 years now and continues to be perpetuated about this remarkable Dutch moment. The Dutch golden age of art transported across the Atlantic. And look at this order and progress that the Dutch brought into the Brazilian Northeast. And I had a problem with that growing up in Brazil. I started to look at the stories, what's come out, you know, the legacy of Dutch Brazil, the Dutch moment, which actually I'll talk about that. I'm not actually being too fair to that author. Wim Kloster is now foregrounding the resistance to the Dutch in that book. But still, this in history, this moment is discussed as this remarkable achievement of the Dutch. And so, absent altogether, because historians tend to mine the aesthetic products that came out of Dutch-held Brazil. And again, this is, so the Dutch-held Northeast Brazil from 1630 to 1654. So out of, so absent altogether is the voice of the Portuguese. And this powerful, and what's obscured is this powerful Portuguese pushback of the Spanish, because during this time, from 1580 to 1640, this is a time of the Iberian Union, which is what sparked this was the Dutch justification to go after Portuguese possessions overseas, all over the world, and the powerful Portuguese pushback of the Dutch. So this is a remarkable story. And the more I delved into this, the more I looked into this, the more I saw that what's obscured is the Luso-Brazilian guerrilla resistance, and what I'm calling now the emergence of a Luso-Brazilian identity. As the Portuguese, my story actually begins in Lisbon, and then I travel to Brazil, and I look at the on-the-ground, in the middle of my work, I look at the on-the-ground maneuvers and these unexpected alliances mm-hmm. as the Spanish troops are recalled. And so who's left on the ground and who is really leading the resistance in the end are men of mixed descent. And this is where we see the formation of the Henriques, this all-black regiment, the an indigenous regiment to fight against the Dutch. And so I look at how the marginalized, actually the so-called marginalized, the overlooked, really pushed the Dutch out of the Western Hemisphere for the most part.
So what are some of the sources that you use, and where did you have to go to track them down?
So I began with the chronicles. One of my main sources is the Father Manuel Calado's O Valeroso Lusitano, the Valorous Lusitanian. I started with Charles Boxer and his History of the Dutch, and his main source was Father Calado. And so what really sort of got me looking was the fact that that was his main source of information, the Portuguese side of the story. Yet by page, I think it was 81, Three times he called Galaldo a liar, a deceitful, deceitful priest, etc. So I thought, well, wait a minute. Don't we kind of need to bring in some Portuguese voices here? Because really, when we read up on Dutch Brazil, it's very Dutch centric. And I understand that 100%. The Dutch West India archive is super ordered relative to this fragmented Portuguese record. And so I zoomed in on O Valeroso Lucideno. And then I started to track down some of the names. So, for instance, Galaldo, and Boxer writes about this, Galaldo writes of this Dona Jerônima de Almeida, who was captured by the Dutch. She was hauled from her engenho in Porto Calvo, and she was tried for treason, and she was sentenced to death. But Johann Moritz commuted her sentence. So that story is told in Galaldo's work, and then it sort of embellished a little later in Boxers and picked up in other subsequent books as an example of Dutch generosity, right? So it's, oh, look how tolerant the Dutch are. And he spared her life. What a wonderful, generous, humane man. So I tracked her down in the old Dutch West India archives, and she has a deposition. And I wanted to know, what did she have to say about this? And her deposition's in Portuguese. She describes the fact that she knew nothing of what was happening. She was only making dinner that night. How could she possibly know anything? She was illiterate. And so with that, I had to dig a little deeper and say, and thanks to Deborah Hamer, who reads Dutch, I reached out to her. She's doing work on the Dutch and Brazil from the Dutch side. She looked at the Dutch documents and she helped translate it and corroborate what I was saying. The fact that, in fact, you have women who are clearly engaged. They're not submissive. You know, this is the Dutch side of the story. They're not submissive, cowed by their husbands, doing absolutely nothing. But they were engaged. So I went to The Hague, and a lot of those documents are fully scanned now. I went to Lisbon, and my main archive was the Arquivo Histórico Ultramarino, the AHU, and the Biblioteca Ajuda, so which was great because they're on the same street. So I came back and I told my students, if you ever plan a research trip, make sure you watch that. What time does the archive open? I'd go to the top of the hill, the Casal da Boa Hora, and I'd go to the top to the Biblioteca Ajuda, and then down, and I'd stay there from 9 to 1, and then walk down the street, because it was a long walk. I walked down the street to the HU. Let's see, where else did I go in Lisbon? So those were my two, and the ANTT, the Tohitombo, Arquivo Nacional Tohitombo. For my work prior, to take a good look at what was happening prior to the restoration of Portugal in December 1640, I traveled to Madrid. I really would like to do further research and travel beyond. But I went to the Biblioteca Nacional España, so the BENE, and another archive in Madrid as well. I went to the Library of Congress. I've been to the New York Public Library. Trying to think, I'm sure I'm missing something, but I mean, this is what I had to do, is just travel. And I want to mention, Stephen, that there's a big debate, right, about, well, if you can get all the documents, which in my case I couldn't, but if you can get so many of the documents online, given our funding issues as scholars, why travel at all, right? And so which I totally understand, especially with the issue with funding, which is a critical issue to scholars. However, what I like to share with my students was the importance of being in a location, feeling that the environment. Mm-hmm. It was, right? So when I was in Lisbon, it was then, you know, and I'm in a subway, and this is going, my stop for the ANTT was the Cidade Universitaria, out on the outskirts. This is the university. And there's a quote by, right on the subway walls, you know, Antonio Vieira. So, you know, when he's talking about what it means to be a citizen of the world. And everywhere I looked, I felt Vasco da Gama, you know, Vieira. As I walked around Lisbon, I went out to Belém. And then also, when I went to Spain and working in the archives there, I suddenly, this is what I told my students as well. I said, now I understand the Spanish Empire, and now I understand the differences in working the different archives. So I went through the records there. I looked at the chronicles that have been transcribed. So I was able to research them here, and I was able to go through different letters there in the ANTT, and the AHU especially is especially useful, as critical to my work. And a lot of, and I would not have been able to really appreciate all the richness had I only done the work stateside and online. And I am very grateful to Georgia State University, has been extremely generous in funding my trips abroad. So, and then also I mine art, and especially the sermons of Antonio Vieira, who was a Jesuit priest. He was the first eyewitness to the Dutch invasion in 1624. He was a 16-year-old novice at the time. And like most of the folks in Salvador, he escaped to the backlands, and he stayed at an aldea, a Jesuit-run village by the Rio Vermelho. And he was tasked with writing the annual letter to the Jesuits. And it only came out 2 years later because of the Dutch occupation of Bahia. And so it's what I've done is I've used his work and his sermons as well.
Outstanding.
Yeah. And there's so many sources. So those are some of the main sources.
Fabulous. Now, if I may pivot.
Yes.
You mentioned briefly a little bit earlier that you are also an author of historical fiction targeting the young adult crowd.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by this. And it's three novels that you've published?
It's three. Yes, that's correct.
And I think you mentioned in part some of the inspiration behind it, but if you could develop that further. I mean, I'm fascinated. What was the inspiration? How did you choose the stories? What was the process to publish?
My inspiration came from the fact that I learn best when I'm reading stories. So I have no problem saying that I hated history in high school, except for I did enjoy APUS. That was actually pretty interesting. But I hated the fact that this information was tossed up and it's one thing after the other, and memorize all these boring dates. And it was very male-centric at the time, especially, and boring. But I learned best by reading historical fiction. And actually, I have to tell you, that's kind of how I got through APUSH, you know, reading John Jakes and Men Mitchell, you know, James and Michener. I read all the, and even, you know, by that time, I know this is terrible, or not. I knew what the antebellum South was by reading Gone with the Wind. So, you know, so I had some context because it's how do you take people back? And as an instructor, time traveling, as a history instructor, we time travel every day. Every time we walk into the class, we're inviting our students to go back in time with us. And that can be a hard sell unless you have a good story, because I think it's human nature to be interested in the story. So, the theory is wonderful. Facts, you need facts. If we're going to write history, you need to start with what we think is true. So I decided to write my first book. Really, this was about a year after I finished teaching AP World. I thought, well, what was the sticking point for my students? And I noticed this as I taught ninth grade ninth grade history. I taught on level and honors. And so I started with what I knew, which was Chinese history. Now, my master's thesis was on the, so I was not, so my thesis reader was a sociologist, Marty White, and then my second reader was in business. So for my MA, it is true, so I focus on viability of the family firm on Taiwan. But to get there, of course, I had to know something about the Chinese family and Chinese history. And so I started with what I knew and what made sense to me, because also I wanted to bring in that feeling. What is it, again, what is the experience of living in China, and what is it? What does it feel like? What are the sounds? What does it smell like? You know, I believe in the sensory experience. And I think beauty of the teaching, especially teaching high school, is, you know, you can close the door and it's your world. You're traveling in time together with the students, and you can make it whatever you want. And I found that teachers I found it relatively easy to integrate China into the narrative, but I heard from other teachers that they struggle with how do we pronounce these names? I don't understand what's happening. And so how do we fit in Buddhism? How do we fit in women, etc.? And so I looked at 1521 because that's this moment. By this time, the Chinese have turned away from exploration. The edict has come down to turn away from traveling at the time that the Portuguese and the Spanish are now, and then later the English and the Dutch have gone out. So teachers, I found, struggle with this, and sometimes students did too. So that was my first book, Jackie Temple and the Emperor's Seal, and it was a way to handle that time period. And so I have this time-traveling teen. It's kind of, I know you have kids, right? Are your children of reading age?
Yes, yes.
Not for my books, but are you familiar with The Magic Tree House?
Yes, so they read that all the time.
Exactly. So my daughter was reading The Magic Tree House at this time, and my son loved it. My son was not an avid reader, but that was the only book that would hook him in. And so this is the short and dirty version is just saying that this is sort of like the Magic Tree House, but this Jackie Temple, I chose a gender neutral name for a 15-year-old girl. She travels back in time with a book, this magic book that she finds in her aunt's library. And again, for me, libraries have always been a great source of exploration. And as a child and as a teenager, books were my refuge. Mm-hmm. You know, as a bespectacled skinny kid, I mean, who's going to be nice to me about the stories? So, you know, so I would read. I mean, books aren't going to talk back to you. And so that's why I started with China, because I felt that was a sticking point for most teachers and students. And I was really happy that school started to pick this up. I think there was one school on Long Island that made the first book their book of the year for several years. This was, I think it was Rockville Center. And so this was great. So I had all of ninth grade reading that book for quite a few years, part of the curriculum. And then for my second book, Jackie Temple and the Ghost of Zumbi, I wanted to go to Brazil by now, because students really only seem to encounter Zumbi of Palmares, and the whole notion of these amazing, this fascinating story of the Quilombos in AP World History. So this wasn't being taught, and students aren't familiar with the story of resistance. So here Jackie Temple escapes she goes back in time to, and she's looking for her parents who are lost in time and space. This is this whole wacky story. But she ends up in Brazil. I wanted to delve into this is Brazil, the 18th century. And Zumbi is gone. He's died by this time. But so this is the ghost of Zumbi. So it's an introduction for students to look at what is a quilombo. So that's why I looked at that. That's why I chose that story. And then for my last one, was written in the wake of, really, just, I was inspired by 9/11, but with the backlash against the Muslim community, especially in New York, in the wake of the 9/11 attack, I wanted our students to look at Islam and the history of it as what happened in the 10th century and even more, as more than just, I wanted my students to gain a deep appreciation for Islamic culture, especially this is during the Abbasid era, the age of translation. And so this was a big deal in my high school. I took my students to a local mosque. You know, News 12 came out to videotape us. It was a big deal. Oh my gosh, you're taking your students to a mosque. And I thought, well, that's we need a better reaction than that. How are we going to improve conditions if they're with all this fear? So, and what was great was I had a couple of students were very, very interested in discussing sharing their excitement about, wow, this is what a mosque is like. It's totally different from what I had imagined. And so it was interesting to me that despite my best efforts as a classroom teacher, I really needed to bring my students deeper. And I, as a teacher, I really need to bring them into the environment, that is. as much as possible. And so as a teacher, I did routinely every year we would head off to, we were very lucky in New York, we would head off to the Met and I would choose select exhibits and have this interactive experience. Or we would go to, once we went to Chuang Yin Monastery at Carmel in upstate New York. Really, so historical fiction is a way to bring the students back into the past and to create that environment. And so that's what it did for me. And so that was my hope for students and teachers as well.
Outstanding. Outstanding. I think it's really cool. So one of the things that I will do is get these for my eldest daughter, who's 11. She's going into middle school now.
Oh, fabulous. Oh, yeah, I'll send them to you. Don't worry about it. I'll send it to you. So we'll talk afterwards.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, one of the nice surprises that we have discovered here at Historias in this project has been earning the interest of high school world history teachers.
Yeah.
It was unexpected. It was unintended, but they have demonstrated significant interest. They engage with us in social media. And Eric Beckman, the world history instructor from Minnesota, has shown us some serious love. Like he has recommended this podcast, among others, for integration into classroom. And I have to say, I for one have gained a better appreciation of the quality of instruction, the curriculum, and certainly the quality of my colleagues who teach AP history. And I did this when I did the AP read a couple of years ago. I'd never been exposed to it. And I'd been out of high school for a long, long time. As I didn't remember it then. I'm curious that since you have lived professionally on both sides of this divide, what sorts of opportunities for collaboration are out there for those of us, you know, university level instructors and high school level instructors? What sort of opportunities for collaboration are out there that we may not be doing yet?
Yeah, so well, what I'm seeing quite a bit of now, and especially this is through the World History Association, but I see this with Sokolas as well, is the opportunity to share strategies and instruction. And that's one, but also the content. Teachers are always looking for a good story. You remember, you know, we have anywhere, in my case, it was 39 minutes a period to, if you're on block schedule, an hour and a half, but holding the students' interests and bringing them along requires a good story. And so content, I see the gap, I see bridging the gap between delivering the fabulous research that's coming out now and that is out there and this wonderful work that's being done at universities and delivering those stories directly to the teachers. And I see that through institution. I see that through the medium, I really think, or at the conferences. I really enjoyed my experience in Mexico, for instance, the Sokolas experience. It was great to talk about instruction, and I could see so many applications to the high school classroom as well, where podcasts, for instance, you had a wonderful session. Podcasts are a new way to immerse the students in the process of learning, because they need to take ownership if they're going to remember anything. They need to take ownership of the experience. So I see this in instructional strategy, delivering content and instruction. And so I'll give you an example. So I'm very excited to be working with Angela Lee. She has done tremendous work in bridging this gap. She's a high school teacher in Massachusetts, a longtime AP reader, exam reader, table leader. She's on the executive council. She's on the executive council now for WHA, and then also has been on the exam directorship for the AP World Exam most recently. And so we co-presented. I reached out to her last year, and I said, you know, I'm reading so much. I've read so much great work in my grad student seminar, in my grad seminars, and I've been toying with different approaches. So, for instance, Ian, I said, would you be willing to present with me on what I derived from Charles Walker's Shaky Colonialism? And so I was captivated just by reading his work. I was really captured by his approach to the earthquakes, the earthquake in Lima and Callao. And he called this incident analysis. And so I said, well, let's deliver some content and strategies on, let's use incident analysis to talk about how we can talk about world history. And so we co-presented and we're co-writing an article on this, how to use incident analysis in the world history classroom. And she, it was a good reminder to her, to me, that, you know, I get deep into the content now, and she has actual, she's in the classroom, and she has actual methods of how do we take this and break it down so we can deliver it better to high school teachers, to high school students. And I would like to say that when I first started teaching at the undergrad level, I was concerned. I thought, oh, all this is, this is a totally different method of delivery. And I got up even on day one, I thought, I'm not going to straight lecture. I can't, that's just not my style. We have to engage the students, and that's worked very, very well. And so I could just kind of, everything that I've done in the classroom has worked extraordinarily well at the high school level, at the college level, I mean.
Right on. So you're a highly decorated educator, mm-hmm. author, and I only mentioned one of your teaching awards, by the way, as you know.
Thanks.
I'm curious to learn some of your advice about bringing Latin America into the World History Survey. What are some of the best practices that you've developed over time?
Yes, well, my main tool, you know, and again, world history is such a daunting curriculum. I was just corresponding with a grad student who is teaching modern world history for the first time, and he's overwhelmed. And I shared with him my main tool, which is comparative analysis. So I think what's worked well for me, and I think we shouldn't shy away from, are what might seem to be some kind of wacky comparisons. For me, I like to chunk down time, and I use periodization, and we discuss this in class. Why are we, what is this unit of time that we're looking at? And I follow the old AP world curriculum, 1750 to 1914, or 1500 to 1750, for instance. You know, let's talk about these changes and continuities, but also in that period of time, we can look at comparisons. So for instance, we can look at Lin Zexu in China during the pushing back against the British
during the Opium War.
Right. And compare him to, I know this is going to sound wacky, but Simón Bolívar. Totally different different, and we have to have the students look at it's an opportunity to look at the differences, but also what are the forces that are happening at this time.
Mm-hmm.
What about, and look at, for instance, Getúlio Vargas and Kwame Nkrumah, populists who really modified their discourse as they reached out to a wider group of people, Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. You know, what happened? How did the way Getúlio Vargas reach out? What changed after the Estado Novo? And how did he win the elections after that? You know, after he had sort of was ousted for power, but then came back. What was the change in his language? And what do we see in terms of Kwame Nkrumah? What happened? So even though the time period's more or less the same time periods, but I think it's the challenge of world history. One trick I learned was really comparison is so, so helpful, because we, at that point, we want to say world history, the easiest way to approach it is to say, well, what's happening, not just in one place, but in multiple sites. And what does this mean? What is the narrative arc? We can look at millenarian movements, the Taiping Rebellion, Canudos, the Sokoto Caliphate, you know, so taking themes and then breaking down information that way helps us navigate this vast sea we call history, world mm-hmm. history. So that's what's worked for me, especially. I think comparative analysis is not to be underestimated. It's a great tool.
Now, if I can just shift just a little bit, but it's kind of building upon your classroom experience, both at the high school level as well as the university level. As you know, many departments, history departments around the country are worried about a declining number of majors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts, practices, suggestions about convincing students that history is a noble major to pursue?
Yes, and I love your choice of words. Noble as it is indeed. And what I tend to, I don't like to tell my students what to think, actually. I don't like to tell them that they should do one thing or another, that they shouldn't, that one story is more important than the other. I want them to make up their own minds, because they have to. And this is a very confusing world that we live in, and they're being hit with information from all sides. And so with that, what I share with my students what's worked well. So when I tell them that I have several objectives, of course, there's information that there are stories that I think need to come out. Whose voices are we not hearing? And so just speaking to the nobility, you know, just who's not being heard? And why is that important? But what's worked best for me is emphasizing the practical aspects of history and then having the students buy into it via the stories that the journey that we take throughout the semester. I often have a lot of science majors in the undergrad survey. So I discuss the fact that, you know, I'm very upfront and I say, of course, you're never going to remember everything that we learn here. This is on day one. But what are the skills that we can pick up that you can apply in other courses and for the rest of your life? And so with that, it's, you know, immediately we have the fact that we're going to learn content, but there's application, which is really important to me. I think students buy in when they can see the direct application. For science majors especially, one, I actually had a couple of science, former bio majors switch to history a couple semesters.
Done.
Thank you. Because I said, you know, we're looking at all this information. This is data. And we have to figure out what data we're going to look at, what makes sense, and how does it fit together. And these analytical skills that we develop will help you elsewhere. And so then with that, it was sort of like, well, maybe I'll listen to the story. And I have the students challenge the story that's being told. Well, what aren't we hearing? When we look at, these are skills I picked up as a high school teacher too. You know, when I taught IB International Baccalaureate History, and the history of the Americas, just for 12th graders, students for one section of the exam had to look at the origin, purpose, value, and limitations of a document. And that's actually a skill. They actually need to demonstrate that. And so as we do that, even in the survey, I said, well, we're doing the same thing that you have to do elsewhere. If you're doing a science experiment, how do you know what's going to work? Why are you choosing this project anyway? Why is it worth looking at? So these are very similar skills and strategies. So this data before us, how do we group it and how do we use it to make sense of the world and why we are where we are today? And so I hook them in with the practical, and then we get to the stories and we look at, and I ask the students to challenge me. Look, what are we not? Whose voice haven't we heard? What's missing? And that's actually one of my assessments. Always, I have the students look at a document, usually there's a portion of my exams, an assessment, and I look at how does this help us understand whatever it is we're looking at, and what's the limitation? Because students, we all need to learn to question the sources and consider what stories are being pushed in front of us and why. And what else we should consider as we look out and as we try to make sense of this world.
And that is a skill that is desperately needed right now.
Absolutely. Oh, right on. There's no question. I think if I were teaching this semester, and actually I started to turn to this, questioning the truth of documents. And again, I really don't believe in hitting students over the head with information. You should be looking at this because this is terrible in the world. I would rather lead them to it and have them make up their own minds and say, well, wait a minute, I looked at this document and it seems so authoritative. And now I'm being told this about what's happening in our country today, for instance. Well, maybe it's not as authoritative as I thought it was. What else can I find? I mean, we really need that. No question. No question.
Desperately.
Absolutely.
Well, Suzanne, you have accomplished all this while also having a family that you helped raise. How do you balance all this?
Yes, it's called serious time management and lists and working backwards and prioritizing. You know, I think about, well, when my kids were little, really it was about how am I going to get through the day?
Mm-hmm. You know, surviving the day.
Exactly. As a high school teacher, you know, I'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning, I'd nurse my daughter and I'd put her back. And my husband, fortunately, was able to take the kids to daycare. And he's wonderful. He always had the mornings. And then I'd go to the gym and just run for 20 minutes. So running for me. So I run. That's been my mental escape. Even if I don't feel like running, I try to get out 3 or 4 times a week, more in the summer. And so that's one way, you know, again, just working backwards from what needs to be done today. And then as the kids got older, I was able to lift my head up. I mean, really, I would come home, pick up the kids and lie on the couch and pass out and then get up and make dinner, lesson plan for the next day, et cetera. As they got older, especially, I like to have longer range projects and shorter range projects, but also keeping their schedules in mind, my schedule in mind, our family, my responsibilities to my friends and my family. So I would have to say that prioritizing has been one key ingredient. And again, I work backwards from deadlines and I knock off whatever I can as soon as I can. And that doesn't mean that I'll walk into a class or a lecture fully prepared, but if I've done enough work, then I am fully prepared. You know, again, cataloging that, and then also having a good network of good community outside. Case of when I taught high school and even now at the graduate level, communities in the building, on the campus, and beyond. And so this is what's so wonderful about chatting with you, for instance. I know you've survived. You've got this amazing podcast, and we've got this amazing podcast. You do so much yourself, and it's knowing that there are other people who are working through the day and creating as they go along. And also learning, one thing that I've learned as a parent is learning that it's okay to take 15 minutes and handle a footnote or handle one email. I can do that. I don't need, once I became a parent, I didn't have the luxury of now I'm going to have 3 hours to do whatever I want and start writing whatever I want. You learn to take the space in the car, in the supermarket, when you're making dinner, when you're grading. My favorite pastime was, I loved it when my son was wrestling because that meant I was there all day and I could grade a lot at his events. I mean, it was great. I totally encourage my students to do indoor sports. So my daughter played volleyball. So that was great. So you learn to take your work with you wherever you go and find people, find wonderful people like you. And all the wonderful people I met at the Sokolos Conference this March. It was, what a fabulous event. Everyone should go.
Thank you very much. Are you gonna consider Austin in March 2020?
I think so. Absolutely. It's March. I think I should go. Yes, I would like to do that. Absolutely.
Wonderful.
And I would get to see fun people again and share these experiences.
Wonderful. Suzanne, thank you so very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me here. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Suzanne Luttrell is a doctoral candidate in the Department of History at Georgia State University, an award-winning educator and author. For Suzanne, I'm Stephen. You've been listening to Historias, the podcast from the Southeastern Council of Latin American Studies. Thank you and goodbye.